This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The White House is banking on a little must-see TV tonight. The marketing power of old media is another way to think about that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 9th of September. Good as always to have you with us. It's going to be all Obama all the time on television news tonight. The president is doing interviews with six different networks, making his case for an attack on Syria. Tomorrow night, of course, is the speech. Oval Office, prime time. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith takes a look at the enduring power of the television message.
Tonight, President Obama sits down for individual interviews with anchors from the four main networks, plus PBS and CNN. That is a lot of talking. But it's a worthwhile investment for Obama, says Bill Carroll, vice president of Katz Television Group.
The best way to reach the largest number of people is by going on television.
Nightly news viewership is smaller than it once was, but ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox still get a combined 5 million viewers a night. And that time doesn't come cheap. As a candidate, Obama would have had to pay as much as $100,000 a minute for an ad during those shows, which means tonight's six interviews would run well into the millions.
The advantage of going on these news programs before giving a speech is to soften up the battlefield.
Political consultant Hank Scheinkopf says tonight's one-on-one interview is a clever tactic. Tonight, Obama can be relaxed and down to earth. In tomorrow's White House speech, Obama will likely appear forceful and presidential.
He's good on TV.
Kenneth Rogoff is a professor of public policy and economics at Harvard. He says the actual broadcasts will reach older viewers. Younger viewers will go online to watch highlights.
Young people today look at YouTube videos way ahead of New York Times articles, I'm afraid. So it's the medium where you get the most impact.
Obama's not the only leader turning to TV to gain public support. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad will appear tonight on CBS and PBS. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
It's getting harder and harder to find a company that will give you health insurance once you're retired. Both IBM and Time Warner have just announced they're going to end health coverage for retirees and instead give them a check so they can shop for their own insurance on a private health insurance exchange. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill reports.
Okay, Kai just said private health insurance exchange. Keyword here, private. This is not Obamacare. These are private health insurance exchanges for retirees, kind of like big insurance brokers. Paul Fronston is with the Employment Benefit Research Institute. He says there are upsides here if you're one of these retired employees.
I'll have a much bigger choice of plans, and I could pick the plan that I think is right for me.
Just how much choice you'll have, of course, depends on how generous your company's contribution is. IBM and Time Warner aren't the first to dump in-house healthcare in favor of private exchanges. And, says Fronston,
I'd expect to see more employers doing this with retiree health benefits.
Tricia Newman is with the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Many firms are looking to disentangle themselves from retiree health benefits and costs.
Healthcare costs are going up and are expected to keep on rising. Most large companies don't offer any retiree coverage. 20 years ago, about two-thirds did. Moving retiree health insurance to private exchanges is also one less thing for a company to worry about.
It could be that they are just trying to distance themselves from managing their health benefits.
That's not the business they're in, after all. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
I don't know what got into traders today, but Wall Street was off and running to start the week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The World Trade Center is in the news today, and it has nothing to do with the anniversary of September 11th that is coming up on Wednesday. This is a branding story about the actual words World Trade Center and who gets to put them on the signs in front of their buildings. It's not as easy or as cheap as you'd think, thanks to a nonprofit called World Trade Centers Association. Sean Boberg has the story today in The Record out of Bergen County, New Jersey. Sean, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to make sure I read your article right. If I want to build a building and name it the World Trade Center, I have to pay this association a whole bunch of money.
Yeah. Well, $200,000 to start.
Yeah, that's a whole bunch of money.
I think that qualifies.
Yeah.
And then $10,000 a year after that.
Which just seems like quite the racket. How did we come to this point?
Well, the deal traces back to 1986. A legendary Port Authority employee by the name of Guy Tozzoli, who oversaw the construction of the Twin Towers, the originals, he had been very involved with an association that had sort of an interesting relationship with the Port Authority, the agency that built the Twin Towers. It was an association that tried to replicate the concept of World Trade Centers around the world. And on his way out the door on retirement, Guy Tozzoli managed to get the Port Authority to agree to sign over the rights to the World Trade Center name so he could continue that work through the nonprofit that he founded.
And he got the name for $10.
$10. Yeah, he got the name. And that had turned into quite a lucrative business model, licensing. I think they have over 300 licensees around the world.
So we have here in Los Angeles, right around the corner from Marketplace World Headquarters, a World Trade Center Los Angeles, and they are part of the World Trade Centers Association. So they have had to pay now $200,000 plus $10,000 a year to get that name?
Yeah, presumably.
Okay, but here's the thing. It's not like the most hustling, bustling kind of place. I mean, I see it every day, and it's a little forlorn looking. Is it worth it to have this association?
Obviously, some people think it's worth it. But, you know, what's become clear to me is that a lot of building owners, developers see this as a marketing tool. The advertising on WTCA's website says you can get higher rents, you can get higher occupancy rates if you have the World Trade Center brand. That in and of itself may be valuable to a developer.
Yeah, well, I don't know about here because it's, you know, hard by the 110 freeway and it's not the most picturesque slice of land. But, you know, that's a whole different deal. Sean Boberg, he's a reporter for The Record out of Bergen County, New Jersey. He writes today about the World Trade Center brand and trademark and things thereof. Sean, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Down in southern Louisiana, the coastline is moving, disappearing, more accurately. Stronger hurricanes and tropical storms are washing it away, a problem that's only going to get worse as climate change increases. And for all that you hear about people saying the area's rich cultural heritage is a reason to save the Mississippi Delta, there's a lot of oil and gas companies that would like some protection, too. Eve Troe reports now from New Orleans.
Louisiana's Terrebonne Parish is the setting for Beasts of the Southern Wild, last year's Oscar-nominated film about a magical little girl and her swamp community, the bathtub.
The storm's coming! Y'all better learn how to survive.
The fictional bathtub people live outside levee protection. As sea levels rise, they fight to survive. And they look it, a ragtag crew of revelers. Businessman O'Neill Marlborough's family goes back many generations here. He couldn't look more opposite, all resilient good cheer in khakis and a button-down. He's fighting for his community in real life.
We see it now in our lifetime that the water is higher today under its normal conditions than it was 25 and 30 years ago.
Tidal gauges prove it, he says. Marlboro owns an engineering firm that's designed much of the flood protection for Terrebonne Parish. The system can open and close, a consideration made specifically for the oil industry. The huge boats that service offshore rigs need to get in and out.
We got to keep them open for navigation because we depend on that navigation for our jobs.
He drives me down the spine of road along the Houma Navigation Canal. It's lined with mom-and-pop boatyards and pipe fitters, along with big corporate names like Halliburton. At the end, open water with a miles-long wall 12 feet tall and a wide gate in the middle of it. Wide enough to bring in oil drilling machinery for safe harbor in the event of a hurricane.
There's a 200-foot opening. That's a barge that's on a hinge. It's 200 feet by probably 20 feet deep by 40 feet wide. So it's a big, heavy piece of metal. But while it's floating, it's very easy to move.
This idea for a floating door to the huge floodgate came from the oil industry, he says. For decades, oil and gas drillers have learned to build things out on the water. Local firms like Marlboro's have specialized to meet their needs and met government needs in the process.
We've developed some expertise in working in the marsh and the soils that we have to deal with.
That's exactly the kind of expertise Allison Plyer sees as a new economic driver for Louisiana. She heads the Greater New Orleans Community Data Center.
We have the opportunity to become the leaders in coastal restoration, and we know there will be markets for that expertise in the future because the whole coast, of course, of the U.S. is at risk.
Louisiana experts are already in New York and New Jersey, helping out in the areas affected by Hurricane Sandy. But Plyer says now's the time to develop those skills into an industry. With higher education programs. At Delgado Community College in New Orleans, Betty Abbott directs the horticulture program. She teaches her students to grow all kinds of things, including native marsh plants.
This doesn't look like much. In fact, this looks like a weed you'd have in your backyard. This is a grass. It's quite easy to propagate, so I could get 8 plants from this 1 1-gallon plant.
She's taken students from around the country down to Grand Isle, a barrier island off the coast of Louisiana. They brought little plugs of grass to replace what's washed away in hurricanes.
We had a trailer full that we brought down there, and we totally replanted that berm. Those berms that are right there on the beach of Grand Isle is the first defense.
The students were taken by the beauty of the landscape, she says, and they saw what those little grasses that hold the sand together help defend. The cranes of Port Fouchon, where hundreds of supply boats come and go to serve offshore rigs. 18% of the nation's oil supply relies on this port.
And then they realized the economic importance to the rest of the country. So it's like, we get it. We get why we need to do this.
On the way home, she says, water lapped at the one road from the island. The oil industry and government don't seem to be counting much on Grand Isle for protection. They've spent hundreds of millions to build a high-rise bridge to Port Fouchon, high above the old road and high above the marsh. In New Orleans, I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Coming up, first things first, I guess.
Ultimately, you know, our goal is to go to Mars, and going to an asteroid is the next real logical step to go do that.
All right. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials put on 140 points today. That is nearly 1%, finished at 15,063. That's 15,063. The NASDAQ up 46 points, about 1.25%, 3706, the number there. The S&P 500. White Rose, 16 points. Thanks for asking. 1%. Wrapped at 1671. That one did. Privately held retailer Neiman Marcus was sold for $6 billion. Koch Industries bought an electronics component manufacturer for more than $7 billion. That high-tech company, Molex, rose 31% today. Hovnanian pounded up 2% after the home builder said prices are rising. D.R. Horton added 6.5%. Lennar constructed a 5% gain. Blue Chips Alcoa and Caterpillar both scooped up more than 2% today. In financials, Morgan Stanley bumped up about 2.33%. Citigroup added 1.75% on this Monday. Bond prices, while they also rallied, the yield on the 10-year T-note edged down. 2.91% was the yield there. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its monthly job openings and labor turnover survey. The Senate Judiciary Committee is scheduled to discuss conflicts between state and federal marijuana laws. And the truth is still out there. 20 years ago, the X-Files series premiered on TV. It ran for 9 seasons. Not long enough. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. It is that time of year again, gang. Another Apple product launch will be with us on the morrow. A new operating system, probably. A couple of other updates, likely. And, oh yeah, 2 new versions of the iPhone 5, something at the top end, of course. And for the first time, a downscale model to be understood as cheaper. For the first time, also, Apple is going to roll out its new stuff not only here, but in China as well, which is becoming a huge market for the company. So, is a cheaper iPhone going to sell in Shanghai? Our man there, Rob Schmitz, did some asking around.
The one thing Apple has going for it in China is cachet. And that's why Tom Doctorov, Asia-Pacific CEO of ad agency JWT, thinks offering an inexpensive iPhone to the Chinese is a very bad idea.
One of the golden rules of marketing in China is that anything that is displayed in public can command a huge price premium. And the reason for that is status is a primary driver here, much, much more so than in the West. And so when you offer a inexpensive iPhone, it immediately signals that this isn't so elite anymore.
Buzz for the iPhone has been wearing off here. A report from global analyst Canalys shows that in the last quarter, the iPhone fell from 5th to 7th most popular smartphone in China. It was overtaken by the Chinese firm Xiaomi. That company just released a new affordable phone that's generating a lot of hype. Charlie Custer, who edits the blog Tech in Asia, says Apple won't be able to compete with a new slew of Chinese phone makers like Xiaomi on price.
Even the cheap iPhone is going to come in above what the Xiaomi costs. And so then, okay, it's not a luxury phone, but it's also not as inexpensive as this really nice inexpensive phone. So who exactly is going to buy it? You know, I'm not sure.
The answer may come this week. Apple's been in talks with China Mobile to help sell the iPhone. That company has 745 million subscribers. If that deal comes through, then iPhones, inexpensive or not, will suddenly have a market more than twice the size of the one at home in the U.S. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There was a good deal of buzz last week about the encryption of online data and how, if it really wanted to, the National Security Agency could crack whatever code it had to. None of that bodes well for the privacy of our emails or our banking records or pretty much anything. So today, Google said it's going to try to outgun the feds by beefing up its encryption. Marketplace's Queenie Kim reports.
Most of the data we give Google in emails and searches, that's encrypted. But eventually, all that information ends up on Google's servers, and when they pass that data back and forth, it's not encrypted. Google said it's going to start encrypting that data. Matt Blaze is a cybersecurity professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
And essentially what that does is makes it more difficult for the NSA to make any sense of communications that it intercepts without Google's cooperation.
And Blaze says it's not just the National Security Agency. We've known for a while that countries like China and Russia are trying to get a hold of our data, too. He thinks companies like Microsoft and Amazon are making similar updates. Matthew Green is a cybersecurity professor at Johns Hopkins University. He says, looked at one way, today's announcement is a PR offensive.
They're announcing this today to make sure that people know that this is important to them.
By people, Green's talking about companies that store their data and do their computing on Google's servers. By one account, cloud services rang up about $18 billion in worldwide sales last year. But cybersecurity experts say the effectiveness of Google's new safeguards will probably be short-lived. Dan Kaminsky is a cybersecurity expert.
It is an arms race, and the other side holds all the cards.
Still, Kaminsky says if Google wants to compete for business abroad, it's got to show the world that it's doing everything it can to keep its data private. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
The protests in Egypt are smaller now than they were a month ago. The streets aren't as violent. But the economy there is still a mess, thanks in part to the aftermath of those protests. Because you can't buy and sell things if you can't move people and products easily around a country. Kimberly Adams reports from Cairo.
Egypt's passenger rail system is suspended until further notice, another consequence of the state of emergency and curfew that started last month. Passengers still show up at Cairo's central train station, surprised to find doors locked and blocked by police. And even frustrated customers who call the railway's hotline don't get much information.
We still don't know when it will open. You'll find out from the TV.
The Egyptian National Railway says it's lost more than $10 million due to the suspension, and much of that business is going to microbus drivers. Just outside the train station, there's a hectic depot where microbus drivers shout out their destinations, trying to lure thwarted train passengers. Passengers like this woman, who didn't want to give her name, climbing into a microbus after she found out the train to Alexandria wasn't running.
It's okay for me to take the bus in these circumstances we are living, but before, I preferred the train.
30-year-old Mohammed Hassan drives a white microbus with three rows of red pleather seats. He says even though he's getting more customers on his route to the city of Mansoura, he's not making much more money.
After the protests, things started to get better. The influence of the curfew is that passengers are no longer traveling at night.
That restriction is also affecting businesses. Robert Tashima is the Africa regional editor for the Oxford Business Group and says about 90% of goods in Egypt are shipped by road, many of which are now clogged by checkpoints.
When you're unable to ship products overnight, when you've got highways and motorways and bridges that are blocked, then you will obviously have a direct impact in terms of the cost of moving products and your revenues.
One local shipping company told state media here it was losing 50% of its revenues every day during the worst of the curfew. The government is responding, pushing the curfew back from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. now, except for Fridays, a traditional protest day here when people still have to be in by 7. Egypt's packed metro system is also losing money, about $70,000 a day when the curfew is at its strictest. Despite all the short-term losses, Oxford Business Group's Tashima expects things to calm down, eventually.
While Egypt won't suddenly find itself seeing double-digit growth anytime in the next 24 months, certainly, the scope for long-term growth and potential remains fairly unabated.
And Egyptians, as several passengers were quick to point out, will do what they have to get where they want to go. In Cairo, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
NASA launched this country's latest space mission last week, an unmanned probe that's going to study the moon's atmosphere for a couple of months. Meanwhile, in the human spaceflight category, the Obama administration has something a little bit different in mind. Land people on an asteroid by the year 2025. It'd go like this, in theory. NASA sends a robot spacecraft to put a rope around an asteroid, a smallish asteroid. They drag it into the moon's orbit, and then the astronauts go visit. Audrey Quinn has the story.
Remember the movie Armageddon? NASA discovers an asteroid on a collision course with the Earth.
It's what we call a global killer. Nothing would survive, not even bacteria.
They send a spaceship out to greet the threat. Well, this year, the real NASA announced it wants to grab its own asteroid, but not to save the planet.
Ultimately, you know, our goal is to go to Mars, and going to an asteroid is the next real logical step to go do that.
That's Robert Lightfoot. He's third in command at the space program. He says the trip would test deep space technologies, technologies NASA would need for a trip to the Red Planet, all on an asteroid about the size of a school bus, small enough to be towed to the moon's orbit.
It seems to me it's not a good use of the taxpayers' dollars.
Republican Lamar Smith heads the House Science Committee.
It doesn't help us get to Mars. It doesn't really help us learn more about large asteroids that we might want to deflect. So there just doesn't serve any purpose.
A Senate committee approved the asteroid capture plan this summer, but Smith's House committee turned it down.
This is an era of budget constraints. This is a mission that experts say will cost $2.5 billion, so it may fall from its own weight.
The actual price tag's a matter of debate. But whatever the bill, private companies might be willing to help NASA out if they get what they want. They want to park themselves on asteroids to mine metals, hydrogen, and oxygen. Space companies would use these natural resources to make rocket fuel and spare parts, which could serve as spaceships on their way, for instance, to Mars.
It's an oasis and a gas station all in one.
Rick Tumlinson's a founder of Deep Space Industries. It's a futuristic mining company that proclaims it is time to begin the harvest of space. Tumlinson says NASA could offset its asteroid program costs through partnerships with private companies.
We can not only do it far cheaper, we can also begin to create a new economy that develops new resources and new jobs and begins to inject new wealth back here into the world.
Deep Space Industries and at least one other company are to present their ideas at a NASA workshop later this month. Congress won't vote on NASA's budget until this fall. In New York, I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which I am sorry to have to tell you that we as a country are less happy than we were a year ago. The United Nations is out with its second annual World Happiness Report, which is dedicated to the proposition that quality of life ought to be measured and ranked, just like gross domestic product or leading economic indicators, shall we say. Anyway, we come in at number 17 behind Denmark in the number one slot, followed by Norway, Switzerland, the Netherlands, and Sweden in the top five. Must be something about those Scandinavians. I don't know. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow added 140 points, about 1%. The NASDAQ added 46 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 rose 16 points, also 1%. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.